King of the Worshipers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live, but not video streaming today because I'm on location. We're going to talk about that alcohol that I've been telling you about for decades, at least since I wrote an article on it 45 years ago, that there's no amount of safe alcohol. Well, guess what? It took them 45 years, but mainstream science in the last day has confirmed it in multiple scientific reports and new services from the BBC and other sources. Well, think of all of you who were not imbibing in alcohol, but instead of juices and clean water, your livers, your brain, your eyes are healthier. We'll get into that, than those who thought, oh, what's the big deal? Also today, we're going to give you the latest on vaccines, especially since there's now a push for more mandatory vaccines in more states. Working quietly behind the scenes is the American Legislative Exchange Council, an organization that should have been put out of business a long time ago. It's been operating for over 30 years, creating tens of thousands of bills that become laws, and they're using California as a test case. Well, they had a lot of people who are pro-vaccine. Unfortunately, the media was not even handed in presenting evidence, and there's at least 20 individuals, myself included, who all have spent at least 15,000 to 20,000 hours reviewing all the scientific literature to show that vaccines can neither be shown to be safe. That's not humanly possible. There's no scientific study in the world that can show a vaccine has got only safe ingredients in it. It's the degree of toxicity versus their efficacy, and efficacy is a completely subjective subject. So I've invited Richard Gale to challenge the orthodoxy and bring the latest information, information you have not heard before, on today to put all this in perspective. For those of you who are concerned about what is happening with school teachers, especially inner city school teachers, I'll play a little clip from them. And also, why aren't we paying attention to the ozone hole anymore? We should be. From our environmental segment, we'll deal with that. And time permitting, I'll also play this piece where documents were uncovered that shows absolutely positively the United States illegally breaking international treaties, smuggled weapons, Gaddafi's weapons, through Benghazi into Syria and Turkey in order to work with terrorists. There's also a new report today that we have been supporting terrorist groups. Yet the mainstream media will not touch this, but it's been going on through several administrations. So as you see, we have a lot to share. And we always begin with the latest on health and healing. I'm going to begin with the report that was just out yesterday about stop drinking alcohol because it leads to dementia and other conditions. Well, what it does, it shows that, according to the BBC, and they ran a segment on their health hazards and habitual alcohol consumption, that it creates inflammation, and the inflammation can then lead to swelling in the brain, destruction of your liver, destruction of your kidneys, destruction of your heart, the very things I've been saying, macular degeneration and cataracts also. And so there is no such thing as a safe amount of alcohol. Now, that's not to be self-righteous about it, because if you've ever been to Italy and gone into the country, or Spain, or Portugal, less so Portugal, but more Italy, Spain, and France, you'll notice that many people grow their own grapes, ferment their own wines. Now, it's very high in probiotics, very high in resveratrol. They're using the whole grape. And for pure connoisseurs of wine, the homemade tastes similar to apple cider vinegar. It's like a bitter, but they've adapted a taste to it. Now, that has almost non-perceptible amounts of alcohol, almost zero. So it's healthy for them. They also eat the grapes. That's healthier still. drinking grape juice would be even still healthier. And it helps lower your LDL cholesterol, triglycerides, helps strengthen your heart, oxygenates the cells, turns off inflammation in the brain, the kidneys, the liver. So grapes are good in a full spectrum way and are hence one of nature's most perfect fruits, especially if you can get them organic. Then what we did is we took the idea that the French have what's called the French paradox. They have high fat in the diet, yet they don't suffer from heart disease at the same level, even near what we do. And so they thought it was because they drank alcohol. It wasn't true. They took out of the equation the fact that they have a high amount of fruits and vegetables, far more than we do. They substantially participate in the Mediterranean diet, not as much as the Italians, the Greeks, and other people in the area, like in Sardinia, live much longer lives. Crete, the island, they have one of the longest lifespans in the world per population, probably the longest. It's not the Japanese. As a population, the Japanese have the longest lifespan. But that's changing now because of the change in their diet and lifestyles of the younger generation that have gone towards a Western type of lifestyle and diet. In any case, now the science is there, and this is not the first science, but hopefully it'll be the last to convince people, just like cigarette smoking, it's not good for you. And yet for the last 30 years, doctors have been telling their patients, drink some alcohol each day, it's good for your heart. Just the opposite is true. The alcohol will destroy folic acid, vitamin B6, and vitamin C, three of the four nutrients you need, along with TMG, trimethylglycine, in order to lower your homocysteine levels, that silent inflammatory marker the liver produces, that when it's elevated, you're more likely to have a heart attack or a stroke. The lower your fibrinogen level, C-reactive protein, and homocysteine, the safer you are from a heart attack or stroke and cancer. So the bottom of this is stay away from alcohol. It destroys your immune system. It prematurely ages you. It will create massive amounts of oxidative stress that hurts all the organs and cells in the body. Also, from the UCLA, as well as the University of Vermont, an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association today shows that the more you do to promote your cardiovascular health, the lower your risk of dementia. Now, why is this important? Because I can't speak for your background and family, but I can certainly speak for my own and the people in my community. And that is that you didn't exercise after high school or college. You didn't eat healthy foods because it was the 1950s and 60s. You ate frozen foods. You ate more and more frozen TV dinners. You had no problem having aluminum foil wrapped in all the foods, including that which you put into an oven. So you had a lot of aluminum in the body. And you smoked, you drank, and not to get drunk, but up close to it. So imagine what could possibly go wrong. You're not dealing with stress in a good way. You're drinking to take the edge off your stress. You're eating as a comfort food. You're vegging in front of television when you weren't working. All those are predictors of dementia. So our parents, and not our grandparents, that was a generation before, those born before the Great Depression and up through the 1930s, they worked vigorously. They had a healthier diet. America was more of a rural economy. We had a very grand society. We had over 1.5 million farmers. It was normal for people to have a lot of fresh produce. All that changed with the modernization. And with that, everything came out of a box. And therefore, you just mix whatever was in the box and the can was always, it was fruit, it was sugary. If it was vegetables, it was salty. And plus the lead from the can where the seal on the lead was leaching into the food. So from the 1940s to this day, we have had a revolution in industrial food. And industrial food is garbage food. It's sick food. So the fresher the diet, going back to the peasant's diet, going back to what poor people historically have eaten, grains, tubers, nuts, seeds, berries, what they could forage, and where there was meat, it was rare, generally on celebration times. If they lived near the water, there were generally fishmongers where they could go and buy their fish. But if they lived inland, they knew not to do the fish fresh because it would cause them to get sick. But they dried and salted fish in the shore towns around the world, and hence they could then transport whole wagonfuls of fish inland, and so therefore people could take the fish, jerk it off, that's where the word jerky came from, throw it in a pot, and rehydrate it with whatever vegetables they were cooking. So they had a wide variety of food, far more variety than what we actually have today. Their grains were ground in stone grinding, where you have two giant stones, and in the middle is a hole, and as you poured your whole rice or wheat, millet, into that, oats, these were all the hard outside fibers. And then they would turn a wheel, and the wheel would grind it. It was a slow process, but then after they finished, what you would have is you would have a coarse, high roughage, high fiber, still intact oils, still intact fiber, still intact B-complex and amino acids, a really healthy whole grain that you could use. And generally they either made breads or they made them into porridges, and that's what they would eat, throwing in whatever root stock that they had, turnips and potatoes, etc. In any case, that is where we left the track. And so today we are promoting cardiovascular health by getting on a healthy plant-based diet, which more and more younger people are, and I'm very happy to see that the young people, at least those young people who care about looking where they did not have knowledge, or maybe were motivated by a conscientious parent or relative, to say, let's take a look at why you shouldn't eat meat. And there's several roads to that conclusion. One is environmental awareness. Another is suffering of the animal through factory farming, and there is no such thing as a humane slaughter. It does not exist. That's not oxymoron. That's what people say to make themselves feel good. Oh, I'm eating some grass-fed beef, organic beef. No, go to watch how they're killed. It's not a pretty sight. In fact, I was up on a farm I never showed this, actually, but because it was so bloody. But how this organic farmer, that everyone would go and buy his stuff, but they bought the stuff like a chicken, and then would go home and cook the chicken. They didn't have to see how the chickens were killed, or the goats killed, the lambs killed, the cows killed, the pigs killed. Had they seen it, it could have made a difference. In fact, there is a recent study that shows that women in particular who see an animal up close and have a few moments to see how it responds are far less likely to want to eat that animal than had they not had that connection. That's one of the reasons that every day I post 3 to 10 different videos on my Facebook page showing animals connecting with humans. For example, today I posted one where a man had rescued from poachers some baby gorillas. And usually they don't kill the babies, they just leave them to starve to death after they kill the mother and the father, and then they take their reproductive organs and they take their hands and they sell them. Now you would think this could stop overnight if the Chinese government actually did anything right, and they don't. They're absolutely barbaric. We conflate two issues. We conflate the fact that they're the world's largest producer of solar, and they're building this international new silk trade route through major communities, spending trillions of dollars. Of course, they're doing that for their own self-interest. But then we don't look at what they do, how they completely destroyed over 50,000 monasteries in Tibet, how they engaged in genocide in Tibet, how they've been take the Uyghurs, and which are a peaceful meditating group, and and put them into military hospitals and while they're alive, and then take out organs, take out their eyes for someone who needs cataract surgery, take out their livers, their kidneys, until they die, then burn their bodies. And they're utterly corrupt at every single level. So if a person lacks all humanity, if they're coming purely from a communist manifesto and a capitalist greed model, and they combine the two, the worst of communism, the worst of capitalism, you get a completely dystopian mindset. And these people don't blink when it comes to doing anything that you would consider a crime against humanity. They don't even blink. And yet we will never talk about that. That's just not on anyone's radar. That's unfortunate. So in any case, because if they wanted to stop the trade in tigers and eagles and all the other animals that are supposed to have aphrodisiac qualities, or the shark fin where they'll catch a shark and cut off its fin, well, you cut off the dorsal fin, that shark can't swim, it's going to die. So millions, tens of millions of sharks have been floating around dead, and yet there's no condemnation. There's no, you idiots, why are you eating that? You think that really is going to give you an erection? How dumb are you? But this is superstition. This is primitive superstition. That's what we're dealing with. And yet you have the Chinese Academy of Science, a very respected group of people. Now, they could put the shame to all this, and they could stop it. They could stop the trading in animals, trading in furs, killing of, now the newest thing is killing giraffes and using their skins in different decorative clothing and whatnot. That's the government that has the power to stop that should. If it doesn't, I have no respect for it. I don't give a damn if they gave everyone in the world a solar panel. If you're out there killing people, if you're corrupt, if you're immoral, if you have no spiritual connection to the reality of other people's lives, then you don't get my respect even if you did some token good. But that's just me. In any case, so here we have what we could do for cardiovascular health. We'll give up the damn meat, but we're not going to. And I know that. And I know why they're not going to. In fact, the more I talk about it, the less likely anyone is going to change. I can't do it on the air, but because I don't have the time. But when I'm at a retreat, I'll do 7 hours of lectures throughout a day, from morning till night. Ask the people been there. And it's all about why we won't change, why we seem incapable of ever doing anything that shows that we care about the interconnectedness of life. These are conversations we're not having in schools. In fact, in schools, you can't say anything unless, are you aware of this? I've stopped teaching. This is the first year I refused to teach. I told the university I wouldn't be teaching again, ever. I'm sick of colleges. I'm sick of professors. I'm sick of students. I'm sick of the whole damn septic system of education. Because now you have to warn your class every time you go to make a word that someone in that class may find makes them feel uncomfortable. If you're going to talk on a topic, you must first warn the class so they are prepared for what's going to come. You're going to say eating meat's bad, and suddenly you're making me feel guilty. You're making me feel shame. I've got to go write up a report on you. You need to be out of this. Where's a teddy bear for me to hug? Well, punk, I would rather offend you by telling you to grow up than to see an innocent animal slaughtered because of your indifference to its suffering. Exclamation mark, 1,000 times over. And any professor who has to warn their class, you should quit. But I forgot, you're a coward. You won't quit. You won't protest. You won't do a damn thing. Because as long as they don't come for you, you're not going to care if they come for someone else. Anyhow, but the reality is, you want to stop global warming? Stop methane emissions. It's the number one polluter, more than cars, trucks, planes. And you think they're going to stop traveling? Do you think they're going to lessen their traveling? Do you think they're lessening their shopping? Lessening their purchasing stuff they don't need? It's not going to happen. So all these feel-good, you know, the Tony Robbins, and let's all get up and clap and look like Francis the Talking Mule, none of this means anything. None of it. It's all a game. The reality shows, you think anybody does anything because of a reality show? Never going to happen. Do you think any politician can be trapped? Any politician. Never happen. You think anybody gives a damn about you in Washington? Nobody gives a damn about you. Do you think your church, especially the Catholic Church, cares about you? Well, we'll have a conversation about that that's going to make your head spin. So you see, it's all a game. You think this non-free speech foundation believes in free speech? Nonsense. It's the biggest hypocrites in the world. It engages in more censorship. Do you think they care about women and their rights? Then ask them why they got Lenny Lopate on the air. Where's the protest? You see, everything is a contradiction. Everything is self-serving. There's just no truth anywhere within that model. Now, you want the truth, you got to step out of that. And there's where the rub is. How can I step out of the truth, seeking the truth, if my existing truth is not self-evident? It's not universal. And the problem is, and I spoke briefly about this yesterday, I mentioned a term, and one of the listeners, my God, he says, Gary, you didn't mean hedonic, you meant hedonist. No, read Aristotle. I meant hedonic. Now, hedonic is a construct coming from the idea that there's a spectrum. And on this spectrum, at the far end of hedonic, is hedonism. And it's then hedonism and then decadent hedonism. For example, if you want pleasure and you want to go dancing, that's great. And so you could go out and go dancing. Have yourself a good time. But what if while you're dancing, you really didn't go to dance? Because the celebrities rarely ever dance. Instead, you went because you could be and get in so nobody stops you. You walk right by all these other people as if you're better because you're well-known, you're famous. Now then, you're not there to listen to music and you're not there to dance. What are you there for? You're there to be acknowledged in the VIP section. And then when you go in the VIP section, these are not people sitting around talking about Aristotle. They're talking about where's the drugs. And there's always kind of drugs and everyone there to benefit you and give you free drugs. Because when you're famous, you're not supposed to pay for anything. It's an entitlement. And the rich talk about the entitlement of the poor. My God, there is no entitlement greater than that of success. And so now, whatever you want. You want sex, any kind of sex, you'll have it. Any kind and as much as you want of any drug and alcohol. So by the end of the evening, someone is vomiting and staggering, and they'll have someone get them out to their car and take them home, put them in bed. And when they wake up the next day, they'll forget what they actually experienced. But that is the far end of hedonism, where it's a decadent hedonism that is meant to only give you a sense of your pleasure for a short period of time, but it's addictive because it was stimulating all your dopamine receptors. And so the acknowledgement of the crowd, taking the photographs of you and the selfies, getting you through that VIP section, having the celebrity photographers and the paparazzi take pictures, the people coming over who are also famous you wouldn't normally see or associate with in your regular job. Now everybody who's famous wants to hang out with everyone else who's famous, and they never bring in anyone who's not, because what are you doing here? Who are you? You don't deserve my time or attention. I got my posse, but your posse are a bunch of idiots. That's irrelevant. I can afford them. Look, all my posse has gold watches and gold rings and gold everywhere, and you don't. So you don't deserve to be in my presence. This is the mindset. Now, I know this firsthand because, A, I counsel these clowns, and, B, I've been there and seen it with my own eyes. My buddies and I used to go all the time and go dancing, have a great time. We love the music. We love the crowd. We love the energy. And then we went home. Nobody had to drink. Nobody had to prance around. Nobody had to act out. There was no ego involved. There was no drugs. There was no debauchery. It was just that was a different type of pleasure. But they're both hedonic, H-E-D-O-N-I-C. Now, at the other end of that, about halfway down that spectrum, you get people who want to have pleasure, but they will only have pleasure to the degree that it does not create pain. Now, change and taking risks, for most people, create pain. The uncertainty of what if I fail? What if I don't do it right? What if something goes wrong? And as a result, they frequently stop themselves. So then they live in a very narrow universe between pleasure, so they have to keep their pleasures simple, something grounded where there's no risk. So that's why most people stick with very predictable and very structured lives, not because they are themselves boring, not because they're not unique, not because they couldn't do things. They could. Most people master many things in their life, no matter what their economic status. We'd like to think that only the powerful and rich ever achieve anything in life, but it's not true. Everyone achieves something. And if you don't think it's tough, go out on the streets and live for a week with no income, you're homeless, and see how you master doing that. I just spoke with someone this morning when I went for my run, and I saw that he had a bag, a big clear garbage bag, and he had gloves on, and he was going through a public trash on the corner and putting things that he could recycle. So I stopped, and I says, "Can I ask you a question?" And he says, "Sure." I says, "How much will you make with that bag?" He's, "Well, when the bag's full, I'll get about $6. And I said, "And how many of those will you fill in the day?" He said, "Well, it depends upon the time of year." He said, "In the dead of winter, it's very difficult. In the summer, it's better. In the spring and fall, it's very good because more people are out walking and they're buying things and they're drinking water or juices, beer, whatever, and they throw their can in here." And I said, "So on a good day," he said, "on a really good day, I can make about $28. Is that enough to get you a room?" He said, "No, not alone, but if I work with other people during that day, then we'll get together and we'll see that we have enough money to get a room for the night. But at least it gives me enough money for food and toothpaste and things I need." And you realize, wow, he's mastered how to survive in a very inhospitable environment on a street where the landlords are inhospitable to the tenants. We have over 36% of all retail businesses in Manhattan are closed, and the landlords don't give a damn because they can take a tax write-off at an inflated rent to defer to eliminate the taxes they'd pay on the rest of the building they own. And no landlord's a friend to the tenant. My brother runs a tenant association for decades, so I know how bad it is. Over 1.5 million people have lost their jobs because of landlords gouging on the rent. And then you pay the property tax for the whole building. The tenants downstairs do, not the tenants in the apartments. And so here's just a whole dynamic layers being peeled back. You're walking on a street where if you're homeless, you're going to get hassled. And you're now considered a nuisance to the people who live in that neighborhood because they only want to see people who are mirroring their own life and lifestyles and their value. So they equate a standard of living as a quality of life, and they're not the same. You can have a quality of life and be a peasant. You could live in India as a yogi and just live off the good blessings of other people giving you something in your bowl. But you could be happy and blissful. And in fact, my review of this is that you go so far to one end, you're never secure and always have to outdo yourself. And whatever you've done, it no longer holds the same stimulation. You have to do more. And at the other end of this, you go to where you're paralyzed by fear of change. You're not going to change anything. You're going to resist everything, even things that would save your life. Change your diet. Start to exercise. Start to value something. What is the value of your own life? What is the meaning of your own life? These are questions they're not asking themselves, though part of them knows they should, but they stay in that comfort zone. And comfort zones mean that you're assuming that the environment you're in is stationary. It's not. Everything in life is changing every second of every day. Everything we value at one point in our life will be replaced by something else. Almost everyone we value, the older we get, the more we'll lose those people. So there is a expiration date on everything in life. So those who are comfortable in their own life without being bounded by the desire for hedonistic expression of pleasure at the extreme end, which means you're putting your life, your health, your reputation, your family's reputation all at risk because you just, no matter what you're given, it's never enough. And if you doubt me, go down to Wall Street today and go up and ask just the CEOs, just the top people, Lloyd Blankfein and some of the other clowns down there, and ask him. Then go down to Washington, D.C. and ask the same question. Then to go in every government agency and ask the same question. Do you have enough right now to stop being dishonest? Do you have enough to be generous? Do you have enough in your own life so you can start to look after the needs of other people? Do you give a damn about anyone but yourself? Of all the things you've made with all the money you've made and all the things you've purchased, has any of it given you any sense of lasting happiness? Are you willing to try something different? The answer is no, I need more. You need more? You're a billionaire. I need more. So imagine if you're not a billionaire, not a millionaire. What if you're just a careerist, a doctor, lawyer, engineer, accountant, CPA? Then how much time are you going to devote on that spectrum of seeking pleasure compared to the need to not feel insecure? So the more you earn, the more you spend. You end up in a net zero gain. So those who are the most successful, almost always, except for the millionaire and ultra-millionaire class, they're always broke. They couldn't go. They have possessions, but more often than not, those possessions are low in retail value when it comes back to selling them. In any case, it's just part of this whole spectrum of the hedonic principle. Now, if you go to the other end of hedonics, where you're not just interested in pleasure, yes, you want pleasure, and you deserve pleasure. Everyone deserves pleasure. If my pleasure is listening to classical music, that gives me pleasure. I'm a happy person, so listening to classical music only accentuates and has a higher vibration to that. But then you get to a place when you go beyond a certain point, you go into what is known as a eudaimonistic philosophy. That's eudaimonistic. Again, Aristotelian. It is the opposite. Remember, everything in life has its opposite always present. And those are the people who seek pleasure with principle, seek pleasure that allows them to grow, seek pleasure that does not demean nature or anyone else, seeks pleasure they can actually share with other people. And these are people that generally are always seeking solutions to problems without fear being the limiting equation. So they're the light most likely ones to try things. And some things will work and some things won't. And some things will work and accent the pleasure and other things won't. And it's not pleasurable, but it's not a jump off a bridge moment either. It's a moment of reflection. And these are the people who can go into a deeper space and reflect upon what they've done, why they need to do it. And these are the people that whatever they build, they want to go build something else right afterwards. And we don't talk about this in our society because we're told whatever you build, don't do any more. You graduate from college, you don't need to educate yourself, don't need to read a book, you don't need to learn about another culture, you don't need anything. Just keep it tight. Where the whole idea is, it's a moral philosophy that defines which actions will enhance your well-being as an individual without diminishing them. So that's the person who's going to want to drink vegetable juice rather than at the far end spectrum of a person who will drink whiskey, knowing that that's not good for them and knowing that they're not going to like how they feel. But that's that pleasure. They're getting a dopamine hit. So understand that the reason why we don't have a democracy, why we don't have politicians that care about us, why we don't have actors that have any humility, there are a few exceptions, why we don't have any of this is simple. Because we're not looking back at history and some of the greatest minds, including Aristotle and Socrates, who could give us an understanding, a deeper understanding, the superficiality of the intellect today. If people don't want to go to a class except where you're making them feel good, and if you suggest anything that might bring them to a point where they have to confront a reality that was never given to them in their upbringing, then what the hell are you teaching for? So I think that we should re-examine the whole principle of education today and our lives and why we intentionally get ourselves sick in this hedonic extreme. Just some thoughts. I'm going to talk now about a very important nutrient. In fact, it's probably the most exciting nutrient right now being used in clinical practice. It's vitamin B3. It's also known as NAD, and according to Beth Israel Medical Center, it's good for treating acute kidney injury. Now, we know that kidney injury is often fatal and without specific treatment, and it affects up to 10% of all hospitalized adults in the United States and 30 to 40% in low-income countries. Why? Well, because the kidneys are what take the build-up waste products in the blood and help them be filtered out of the body. It also helps to balance fluids in the body. So acute kidney injury can occur from ailments that place the body in extreme stress, and so anything that can help them is important. Well, this article was published in Nature Medicine, and the findings bring clinicians one step closer to an accessible and safe therapy for patients who may be at risk. And so here's what they say. They say, quote, "We were able to detect a drop in NAD in the urine of high-risk patients who were either in an intensive care unit or undergoing a major surgery, and found that oral vitamin B3 could safely elevate NAD in high-risk patients. These findings are very early, but the results suggest that we could one day have a non-invasive test for NAD status and perhaps even treat acute kidney injury by boosting NAD levels." That's good news by any count. So we want to be able to share that with you. Now, also, I'm not going to talk about it today, but NAD is simply one of the six most important anti-aging nutrients. Strawberries, according to the University of Massachusetts, could help reduce harmful inflammation in your colon. Now, the colon is extremely vulnerable for several reasons. One, because it has to process everything that goes into the body. Liquids have to be absorbed from the colon into the body, so we hydrate ourselves. All of the bacteria that's in the body has to be kept in a positive ratio balance, what is known as the biome, meaning that you want good, healthy bacteria, and for that, you have to consume foods that are creating good, healthy bacteria. But the other side of that is when we're not eating right, when we're eating foods that lack fiber, that are processed, such as a bagel, pretzels, pizzas, French fries. These are not good for the intestine. Now, meat is one of the most difficult things to digest if for the body, and that's because it has no fiber. In fact, just imagine what is called normal peristalsis, which is the wave-like rhythmic movement that allows your food to go through this 22-plus feet of intestines. The ascending, the transverse, the descending colon, the rectum. Food has to go through all that. Now, if you're not hydrated enough, it dries out, and hence you get a very constipated phenomena. If you're eating highly allergic foods, for people that might be dairy or strawberries or soy or yeasty foods or foods that have yeast in them like bread, now the food gets in the intestine, now you get allergic reaction in your intestine, you get bloating and inflammation and gaseousness. But when you eat meat, it's like driving on a highway at 70 miles an hour and suddenly you bring it right down to 5 miles an hour. That's what happens in your digestion when you have meat. First, meat takes a long time to get out of the stomach because it has to be broken down. And then the fat in meat has to be digested with bile that's secreted from the gallbladder. And all this mixture should be at the consistency of soup, a thick soup, like a potato soup. But most people don't take their time eating. They're rushed. They're drinking a liquid which dilutes hydrochloric acid and pepsin and pepsigen and lipase in the stomach. So the more you drink with a meal, the more difficult the digestion becomes, the more incomplete it becomes. And so you fill the stomach up mainly with liquid, and then you put food in there on top of that, and then the stomach, in effect, is saying, this is too much, I can't handle this, and opens up a little door called the pyloric sphincter, and all this food, partially digested, not fully, with chunks of food that the intestine's not going to be able to break down easily, that goes in there. And that's why we're overfed and undernourished, and that's also where we have food that sits for days because it doesn't have fiber, in effect, fermenting or rotting in our intestine at 97 degrees. And that's where we end up getting inflammation and polyps and colorectal cancer. So the inflammatory bowel disease is a very painful condition that can cause severe diarrhea and fatigue. And treatments generally are medication or surgery. That doesn't mean it gets to the cause, it just temporarily relieves it. But along comes the strawberry. And a cup of strawberries a day could help keep the doctor away. The researchers are presenting their results today in the National Meeting of the American Chemical Society, and they're saying that the sedentary lifestyle, where we don't exercise, plus our poor dietary habits, high in sugar, animal fat, low in fiber, promotes colonic inflammation and increases the risk of irritable bowel syndrome. Now, right now, there's no absolute number, but I'm guesstimating 3 to 5 million adults report being diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. And that means it affects your gastrointestinal tract, and you can end up with ulcerative colitis, which is inflammation of the colon and rectum. So that can lead right to colorectal cancer, and that could lead to death. So the solution here is strawberries, plus a diet high in fruits and other vegetables, and low in animal proteins, ideally none. So a cup of strawberries a day could help keep irritable bowel syndrome at bay. I'm very concerned about the scientific community and the medical community not paying attention to the association between all the vaccines that children receive at birth or in the next couple years and the increasing incidence of early type 1 diabetes. There was a study out of the University of Gothenburg, which is in Sweden, and women who develop type 1 diabetes before the age of 10 die an average of 18 years earlier than women who do not have diabetes. Men in the corresponding situation lose 14 years of life if they have diabetes early, type 1. And the lives of patients diagnosed at age 26 to 30 are shortened by 10 years. This was published in the British Medical Journal, The Lancet. So we're talking about a lot of people being born normal, getting vaccines, and developing type 1 diabetes. And I believe that we should be examining this. But of course, since there is no honest examination of the relationship between vaccines and diabetes type 1, I doubt that that will happen. I just want people to be aware of this. Now, the Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University talks about the high levels of oxidative stress in males results in lower levels of cofactor needed to make a powerful blood vessel dilator, nitric oxide. Now, you've heard me mention nitric oxide. One of the best ways of getting nitric oxide is to consume beet juice. That would be one of the best. And an antioxidant appears to help level the playing field between males and females of the cofactor BH inside the kidneys, where the fine tuning of our blood pressure happens. And therefore, that could restore similar protection levels of protective nitric oxide. What it means in lay language is that higher the nitric oxide, nitric is N-I-T-R-I-C, nitric oxide levels helps reduce blood pressure in both in enabling dilation of blood vessels and increasing the kidney's excretion of sodium, which decreases the volume of these blood vessels. Also, it helps if you're drinking green juices and having lots of liquids. That also dilutes the amount of sodium in the body and keeps you properly hydrated. So the study was published in the journal Bioscience Reports. So take your beet juice and take vitamin C. That will reduce oxidative stress. And that oxidative stress results from high levels of natural byproducts of oxygen. So the more you exercise, you go for a bike ride, you go for a run, power walk, that's good, but you're increasing oxidative stress. That's bad. So to benefit, have good, then take your glass of vitamin-rich and add some vitamin C, like 1,000 milligrams to beet juice, and then put some coconut water in there. And that way you can trap the free radicals and you end up a lot healthier. And also, the question is fructose an addictive and harmful substance as is alcohol? And Green Med Info has some answer to that because millions of pounds are consumed annually. And in fact, it may be more like a drug than a food and just as damaging and addictive as alcohol. Fructose, which literally means fruit sugar, sounds innocent. And indeed, when incorporated into the diet in the form of fruit, it is, especially raw and organic, like having a peach or plum or an apple or grapes. They're rich in fiber and plant stem cells and antioxidants and phytonutrients. But that's not the same as the processed fructose in isolate form, which doesn't have anything good to it and is as addictive as alcohol and perhaps even morphine. And that's why, according to a study that was published in a scientific journal through the USDA, we now consume about 50 pounds a year of fructose. And that can lead to all forms of addictive behavior. And it can lead to diabetes, insulin resistance, fatty liver, obesity, hypertension, elevated uric acid, belly fat, cardiovascular disease, liver stress, pancreatic cancer, and leptin resistance. So it's bad to the bone. My suggestion, stay away from fructose. And if you want to clean your body, if you've been on sugary soft drinks, that's where you get a lot of it, use chlorella, C-H-L-O-R-E-L-L-A, coconut water, garlic, ginger, holy basil, quinoa, resveratrol, spirulina, berberine, fish oil, astaxanthin, and bitter melon. Those are all good ways of helping to detoxify the body. Now we're going to go over and say hello to Richard Gale, who's standing by. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Any thoughts on what I just suggested?
Oh, I was thinking of it from my own perspective, really. People accuse me of being a workaholic at times, but then also, and there's always that you give off this kind of impression that you feel compulsed and just kind of driven. But there's a deep, deep pleasure and satisfaction that comes from just knowing that, you know, we put together a broadcast and it's being listened to hundreds of thousands of people over the course of the month or whatever. And there's a very deep satisfaction in that. It's pleasurable. And I remember we had that guest on, Andrea Weber from Germany, who spoke about erotic ecology, if you remember, the need for us to kind of get back into our senses. We've alienated ourselves from our deeper senses and just tend to kind of go up into the brain so much, or our thoughts are just in the more grosser peripheral surface aspect of our senses and not to really explore the deep senses. And that elicits a kind of a sense of passion also. And I think it probably makes our souls, they're dancing and they're vibrating and having a much better time when we experience that. So.
Good. Thank you for your insight.
Yeah.
Richard, and we're going to have Andrew Harvey on in the near future. And we filmed Andrew and, he gave us some very deep insights into why we are searching so hard to have fun and be happy and doing all the wrong things in the process that only add to our angst, insecurity, and depression and anxiety. So that is something we can look forward to. Tell us about the latest. Tell us the latest on vaccines.
Okay, well, so Pan gets up there and he's calling, he's putting up a vote at the California Senate for this month to be declared Vaccine Awareness Month. And so this is a major push to people, getting people to push for vaccines. And he references the measles outbreak that's happening in Europe right now and an increase of vaccines right now with HPV. The three vaccines he's mentioning are the HPV, the Gardasil Cervarix vaccine for human papillomavirus, the flu vaccine, and shingles. And he's followed by another senator who comes to his aid and throws out a lot of very ridiculous statistics by the CDC stating that 320 20 million illnesses that are caused every year from preventable infectious diseases with vaccines, 21 million hospitalizations, and 732,000 deaths. These are just CDC figures, and a death by an infection, unless it's just something so clear, but you can't come up with these kinds of figures with any kind of a degree to accuracy that all hospitalizations are due to infection. It's also due to people's immune systems being shot in the first place for why they got the infection. And the other thing is the amount of money that could be gained by increasing vaccines. And that's a study that was originally done by the University of Pittsburgh. It was funded by the Bill Gates Foundation. That's become the benchmark study where they try to calculate annually now. This is that crazy study that was done where they said since the time of Jenner, if we had vaccines for everything, there would be umpteen billions of people who would have been saved of death. It's just a kind of a crazy thing that they calculated going back 200 years since Jenner created the vaccine. I just want to be able to just say, and then there was the promise. There was the big promise that we're going to have cancer vaccines on the horizon. Pan mentions that. This is very misleading, and I think this is very important for listeners to understand. When they speak about us having cancer vaccines, that sounds really very cool. You know, let's face it, you get a vaccine, and it's going to treat you of cancer. But what we have today are really only four so-called cancer vaccines. They include the HPV vaccine associated with cervix cancer. So this is really just a traditional vaccine. The hepatitis B vaccine, which has been associated with liver cancer. Again, this is a standard traditional vaccine. They're now using the tuberculosis vaccine, which is a live virus. It's attenuated, so it's kind of like partially live. It's attenuated vaccine, but they're now giving that for the treatment of bladder cancer. There's this new move showing the viruses will actually attack and kill certain cancers. So this is the next generation of vaccines is going to be related to these kind of genetically engineered infectious diseases that will be incorporated into vaccines for fighting other kinds of disease, such as cancer. And then the only other one, which is, you can argue whether it's even want to call it a vaccine, and this is this one called a spelacel T, and this is for prostate cancer. But what it really does, what they're really doing is they're extracting your own immune cells. They're culturing your own immune cells, and then they're giving them back to you. And now, but this is now being called a vaccine. Okay, so sometimes when you hear this term vaccine being used in the future, as more of these different vaccines get pumped out, this is not the traditional kind of paradigm that we think about vaccines. Concerning this hepatitis B vaccine, though, with reference to the cancer vaccines that Pan mentions, I want to mention this new one that's just now on the market. It was just approved a couple months ago by the FDA. It's by a company called Dynavax, and it's going to be called the Hepaslav B vaccine. Now, this is for hepatitis B, so this is a shot that infants get as soon as they pop out of the womb. And it was rejected by the FDA twice already. On the first time, it was discovered that it was creating autoimmune disorders, and notably of the thyroid. Then, so it was rejected, and then when it was done, a second trial was done. It was discovered there was all these associated cardiovascular events. And during the trial, there were 14 heart attacks amongst those that received this vaccine. But the FDA now has approved this, and this is the rationale. Because that study only had 8,400 participants in it, but to make a really calculated determination of the safety and efficacy of this, we really need 50,000 participants. So in the meantime, we will approve this with the like now the company has any incentive whatsoever to go ahead and do a 50,000 participant trial. But this is the kind of rationale that we find with the vaccine industry.
Richard,
Richard,
you and I both know the entire subject of vaccines as a public health issue has not been covered honestly by the media. It refuses to, because who pays its bills? The pharmaceutical industry, a substantial amount of those bills, and the vaccines within the pharmaceutical industry is its single most profitable area because they have no downside. They don't have to prove safety and efficacy to get a vaccine on the market, and they cannot be sued by individuals that the vaccine is shown to cause problems. We see that with the human papillomavirus vaccine such as Gardasil. Well, thank you, Richard. Richard will be working this into a short article. Oh, by the way, we have one devastating article we're going to do live on Monday. You won't want to miss it. I'm not even going to give you an intimation of what it is.
Every time I'm